Well, if you sold your kidney, check in with us. I'd love to find out how much you got for it. Seriously, Scott Carney with us. We're going to talk about one of his earlier books, of course, The Red Market that we've been talking about, and also his latest one, What Doesn't Kill Us. This is an incredible story, too. And your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're going to take your calls this hour. Scott Carney with us, and we're going to talk about his latest work, What Doesn't Kill Us. Scott, give us an overview, and I understand you focused a lot on the Dutch daredevil Wim Hof. We'll talk about him, too. But tell us about this, because, well, let me read the subtitle of the book, because that's important to people. So the title is What Doesn't Kill Us, but listen, how freezing water, extreme altitude, and environmental conditioning will renew our lost evolutionary strength. Now, what does that all mean, Scott?
Well, the idea here is that we live in this sort of technologically enhanced comfort where we have perpetual lighting, perpetual climate control, comforts of every single kind. And those comforts are making our bodies weaker. They are making it sort of difficult for us to achieve where we were evolutionarily. And if you look back, 20,000 years, the humans, our ancestors, had to endure, crazy sorts of variations, right? They would have to deal with snowstorms and raging heat without like a whisper of technology. And what they had were bodily mechanisms that allowed them to adapt to the changing world. Now, because our technology has gotten so advanced now, our bodies don't have to work. They don't get the exercise that they need through sort of environmental stimulus. So what I was doing in this book is examining different ways that we can use environmental stimulus, and this is totally free, right, stuff, to enhance and radically change our body's capacity to function in the world and even thrive in really ridiculously extreme environments.
Now, this fellow, Wim Hof, you thought in the beginning that he wasn't above board, right?
Absolutely. We just spent an hour talking about my extreme skepticism if anything comes of people saying you can get superpowers, right? Where my student committed suicide because she thought she could get superpowers.
Yeah.
And Ian Thorson died getting superpowers. And here I am, I heard about this Wim Hof guy, and he was saying, hey, I can teach you superpowers. I can teach you to go out on a glacier, strip down to your skivvies, and control your body heat so you melt the snow around you. And that not only that, but you can consciously control your immune system. And when I heard that, I thought he was crazy, that he was a charlatan. And worse than that, I thought he would get people killed. So what I did is I took a magazine commission that eventually ended up in Playboy magazine, and flew to Poland, where he ran this rustic training center, and where he was charging people $2,000, I believe, to do a week-long training program with him. And I signed up, and I took his training program, sure that I would see it just all fall apart in front of me, like I'd seen so often before. But instead, after a week, I learned two basic techniques. One technique is this breathing method that he does, where you hyperventilate, and then you hold your breath, and you hyperventilate, and you hold your breath, and you end up holding your breath for a really long period of time. I can hold my breath for about 3 to 4 minutes.
Yeah, almost like you pass out, practically.
You can push yourself to that point, but with training, you won't. You'll just be fine for that time period. And the other thing he does is cold exposure, where you are essentially standing out in the snow. And mind you, I'm going to Poland in the middle of the winter. This is the same winter that stopped the Nazi army.
Yeah, that's cold.
Pretty cold, right? And we're standing out in the snow for an hour at a time, and jumping into icy streams and doing all sorts of crazy things, wearing just a bathing suit. And lo and behold, I actually learn his techniques. It doesn't take more than a week, and I am controlling my body temperature.
So you're doing this.
It happens. It just happens. The body is just primed to do it. Because if you think evolutionarily, right, our ancestors who suddenly had this blizzard coming at them had to adapt and change and be able to get their bodies to a place where they can survive that blizzard. And so, the people who weren't able to adapt quickly,
they died. So what would the motivation be, though, Scott, for someone like Wim Hof to want to do this or train people to do it? I mean, generally, most of us won't be using these techniques in our day-to-day living. So what's the purpose?
Well, here's the thing, is that if you have these bodily systems, that and your body is conditioned to adapt to an ever-changing environment, and then you suddenly don't give it that changing environment, then your body is not using critical things that it has evolutionarily grown accustomed to. So if changes were constant, so if you go to cold, for instance, that will tweak your insulin levels. That will tweak the way your metabolism burns fat. That will trigger the muscles along your arteries and your veins and in your extremities to clench and release. And if you never give your body the signals, it doesn't do these things. And that leads to all sorts of sort of biological dysfunction. One of the ideas that has sort of come out of my research and come out of the Wim Hof method is that it could be one of the routes to autoimmune illnesses.
Interesting.
If you think about your immune system as something that attacks threats and you know all these different sorts of cells and stress responses to defend itself from bacteria but also hostile conditions to some degree, if it's not getting any use, if it's not being exposed to, say, germs at a young age or to these stressful conditions, that immune system sort of goes crazy. It goes haywire. And if the immune system is a predator, these tools become something like giving a predator a chew toy. It gives it something to do. And, you know, it's a little bit more complex than just saying the immune system. We're really talking about two sides of the nervous system, that your fight or flight responses and your sort of rest and relax responses, your somatic and your parasympathetic and your sympathetic nervous systems. But the sympathetic nervous system is actually attached to your immune system and immune response.
Well, listen to this story. This happened a year ago, and give me your reaction to this, and then we'll take some calls here, Scott. At least 30 people were treated for minor burns after walking on hot coals during self-help guru Tony Robbins' Unleash the Power Within seminar in Dallas, Texas. 30 people. They burned themselves.
Sure.
Something went wrong, right?
Absolutely. And you know what? I think what happened with there, and you know, walking on coals is not part of my book. It's not something we're evolutionarily designed to do. But what I think happens with the damage to people who walk across coals is when you go to Tony Robbins' seminar, he is so charismatic and so powerful, and you just like, oh yeah, I get it, and I believe you 100%. You know, those people are the ones who generally get burned. And I think the reason for that is that when you're nervous, you sweat. And the bottom of your soles have this very thin layer of liquid on it, but you're only on the coals for like a nanosecond. Like you're actually going off across pretty quickly. And that layer of sweat may protect you. But if you don't trigger your panic response, that is actually, and you believe him so thoroughly that you have you're totally convinced that you'll be okay, I think that's where the danger comes in. But it's interesting because we are talking about the fight or flight responses being sort of misactivated in those circumstances.
All right, to the phones we go. Let's go west of the Rockies. Roger in Shingletown, California. Welcome to the program. Raj, go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing, George?
Great, Raj. Thank you.
The reason I'm calling is one reason is I did a film on this, so I know a lot about it.
Okay. Good.
In vitro fertilization in India from Western parents is really, really going strong. They have clinics in Mumbai, in Hyderabad, even in New Delhi. And there's a doctor over there. Her name is Dr. Patel. And it's totally legal. And what happens is that they get the embryo or the in vitro from the Americans or Germans or whoever. Then they're implanted into basically peasant women there, lower caste. The women are given food and they have babies. They usually have two at a time. They keep the more healthy one and give that one to the parent in the Western country. And then the one that is left over, they'll sell it on the international market.
And they sell it for what? As a child?
Yeah, for sure. They're young babies. My film is called Divya. and it won at Toronto. It won at the Montreal Film Festival.
Raj, how much do these babies go for? US?
I don't know exactly how much. $1 is 70 rupees. So there's a lot of money being made on this. And what we did is we followed a baby from India. It's a narrative. It's not a documentary. But we followed a baby being brought from India to the United States and then showed how they're marketed. So that's what we did in the film.
What's the motivation for a U.S. person to do this? Are they getting big money for it or what?
They don't have to go through adoption procedures. They're illegal adoptions, so if they have enough money, they have a young baby, maybe 2 weeks old. The other thing is that they're assured of their own genetics, even though the mother doesn't carry the baby.
But it's her egg, right?
Yeah, it's her egg and his sperm.
All right, and then the surrogate basically carries the kid. But
in India,
we've got surrogates here too. So why go to India?
It's cheaper in India.
That's what it's all about. Okay, thanks, Ryan.
And then they have clinics there. The parents go over there, pick up the baby, bring him back.
Jeez, Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, that's actually a chapter in my book. I was one of the people to break that story originally for Mother Jones magazine. And interestingly enough, commercial surrogacy was just made illegal in India last year.
Illegal?
Illegal for foreigners to come in and adopt babies, which is actually one of the very... few things that I can say that my work and work like Raj, was that his name?
Roger,
And other, journalists who've covered this thing actually raised enough of a stink about it that we actually got commercial surrogacy shut down for international people. I think it is still legal in India to do commercial surrogacy inside. But the real problem was people coming inside and using India like a baby factory.
How absolutely weird.
And it was cheap. You know, it was like $14,000 and you could get a surrogate, whereas in California, it would be $80,000 to $100,000 to do the same thing, sometimes even $200,000.
And then the surrogate may change her mind and want to keep the kid.
Totally.
That happens.
So what has happened recently is that now the trade for this sort of procedure has now moved to, I believe, Cambodia. It's now that where if you want your surrogate cheaply done and under low ethical standards, you can just go to Cambodia to get it done.
Let's go.
I met women locked in rooms gestating for 9 months.
Jeez. Let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, Scott. Great stuff. On the positive end, for example, like I've run some marathons, and I find some motivation in just being more robust physically. Mm-hmm. And I always used to think I could do a border run if I was in some country and I needed to get to the border like 15 miles away, I could run for it. But on the negative end, I think what you're saying, I think people overdo it with trying to get peak performance and experience.
Sure.
You got college kids studying and they're taking speed to get an A on a test in places like Yale. You know, you've got sports performers like taking steroids or something. My other question would be about JFK Jr. That was 18 years ago, I think, this week. And I had heard he had done some extreme things in terms of like kayaking in the most dangerous river in China.
He pushed himself, Joe.
Yeah, and I wonder if that tied into his eventually taking too much risk. And then my last question was, how did the woman like you in India?
How did the woman what?
Like you in India, as an American. Did they find you interesting,
Or hot. Is that what you're trying to say, Joe?
In India, there's certainly a level of white privilege where people think that white people sort of get treated much better, and foreigners get treated much better than locals. And so, it's very easy to operate there, and it's also an English-speaking country, which is, makes it easy for Americans and British to get around. I don't know anything about JFK Jr.
I think he did push himself, Scott. He was a good pilot. But, he flew on a night that he should not have been flying. And I think when he thought he may have been going up, he was going down, heading for the ocean. Conspiracies aside.
Crashed off Martha's Vineyard, is that right?
Yeah. It was a very horrible, tragic story. But the Kennedys by and large, were risky taking people. That's what they did. You know, they were encouraged to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx now. Welcome to the program. Hey, Joe.
George, how are you?
Great.
Okay, great. Yeah, I wanted to ask Scott now, can you give me an update on the Oregon poaching of Chinese prisoners in China?
Most recently, like in the last 2 or 3 years, I don't have anything particularly new to state that, other than that the Chinese government says they stopped doing it, but at every time it gets reinvestigated, it looks like they're still doing it. So that's about what I know in the last 2 years. We knew before that it was rampant, right? They would imprison people for political offenses. They would tissue type them, and then they would extract organs on demand for people they tissue typed. And you know, there's a book. You know, there's my book, of course, The Red Market, which talks about it. But there's another book that came out a little bit before called Larry's Kidney, which is a comedy book, which is about somebody who travels to China with his cousin Larry, and they get a kidney from a prisoner that they say right in the book is taken on demand. And it was crazy because the guy wrote it as like sort of a weird, culturally funny travelogue, look what you can buy in India. But the grim reality was that someone died to get it.
We have Mary in Spokane, Washington now, first time caller. Go ahead, Mary.
Hey, George, oh my, it's great to get to talk to you. And Scott, whichever subject you want to go on, I'm a disabled vet. I was all over in the East. I've been to Bosnia, and I've been to several states. And
well, thank you for serving. Thank you for serving.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead. Do you pick the topic.
It's kind of odd. When someone says, you know, it's kind of awkward because I don't really know what to say. It you know, it didn't used to do that. I'd always say thank you, but anyway, and now, I mean,
thank you,
you know.
For calling. I appreciate it.
That's nice of her.
Yes, it is. It's very nice.
So, of all the stories you've uncovered,
mm-hmm.
which one do you find the most strange, the bizarre story?
Well, you know, strangest. What it has been the most a rewarding thing of this career is I started in a very dark place, and I found the horrors of the organ trade. I found the horrors of pursuing these sort of cultish spirituality, and then I finally found something truly great. In What Doesn't Kill Us, I found that you can use the environment to train your body to do crazy things. And you know, I was training with Wim Hof. We were taking ice baths, and we were, you know, warming ourselves up literally in buckets of ice. And by the end of the book, I've gotten to such a point that I actually climbed up Mount Kilimanjaro, which is the tallest point
huge,
in Africa,
yeah.
Wearing just a bathing suit, where the winds were blowing at negative 30 miles an hour. And not only that, we did this ascent in 28 hours, which is about three times faster than anyone does it because of altitude sickness. Because if you ascend so quickly, the low oxygen in the atmosphere can give you something called acute mountain sickness, which could be a fatal condition.
I think, Scott, I'd want to be in a parka. But let's come back and take some final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we're talking zombies and creatures with Jonathan Mayberry, so make sure you're part of the program for that. We're going to come back in a moment with Scott Carney and take final phone calls. George Norrie back with you, along with Scott Carney, noted author, of course. And where can people still get your book, Scott?
You can pick them up on Amazon or my website. The Red Market, What Doesn't Kill Us, and Death on Diamond Mountain.
And what are you working on next, Scotty? What's your next project?
I just signed a contract with Rodale, which is the publisher of What Doesn't Kill Us,
mm-hmm.
a book called The Wedge, where I talk about how to use external stimuli to take control of your autonomic nervous system.
Now, that's an interesting twist.
It's really fun. I can't really talk about it yet because I'm still in the middle of the research.
Yeah, I understand.
It's going to involve a lot of really crazy things, including me being dropped into the middle of some feasting sharks in a shark cage.
Yeah, please stay in the cage and make sure it's a thick cage. Anthony in Birmingham, Alabama, is with us on the wildcard line. Anthony, go ahead.
Hey, George. Great show, great guest.
Thank you. Yes, he is.
Back in the 90s, I met this girl at a library, and I became extremely infatuated with her. And she was into Eastern mysticism. And after a while, she introduced me to this author, and he was a spiritual teacher named Chief Little Summer. And he was a teacher of the Kundalini meditation. Mm-hmm. And I studied and studied. And finally, when I did the meditation the first time, I had actually penetrated intelligent infinity. And it had accelerated me so much that it started to kind of freak me out, because I had attained this accelerated self-awareness that kind of brought me very close to the edge. And I realized I needed to pull back, or I was going to go over.
Right, right. That's called Kundalini syndrome in the literature, where you sort of have this snake-like energy that comes from the root of your spine and not the top of your skull. But it's either a spiritual awakening, or it's a sort of self-induced mental break, and maybe it could be both at the same time. But yeah, it's well recognized in the literature. In the Tibetan literature, there's something called lung, which is very similar, where you get very intensive into meditation and then you lose grounding. You don't know how you connect with the world anymore. So yeah, that thanks for sharing that story.
In that tragic case of Emily O'Connor, did you ever get a chance to talk to her friends or parents? I mean, did at any time they say she's got some emotional issues here, or there's a problem?
No, I mean, I did speak with them, of course, but no, this was a shock. What we knew is, you know, she went through adolescence like everyone else, and I'm sure she had her difficult times in adolescence and in college, but she was a very stable, driven, really great person, and there were no real obvious warning signs, unlike other kids on this program that I was teaching who were clearly issuing warning signs. They were talking about sort of connecting with extraplanetary intelligences in their meditations, and I thought that was a sort of a warning sign that maybe I should watch this person. But that was not what was going on with Emily. She was the most centered of us all. And in a way, perhaps that is a predictive factor, right? Because somebody who is so driven and so sort of perfect in their understanding of things might also be seek for perfection in their spiritual life as well, and maybe even derailed a little easier than someone who, you know, has a crazy idea and then flits off to the next crazy idea 20 minutes later.
Let's go to Dan, truck driving in Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Hi, Dan.
How are you doing, Mr. George?
All is well, sir. Thank you. Hope you are too.
I've been listening for decades to this
station. You.
Whenever I can, and I just changed my schedule, so now I get to listen to you just about every night.
Perfect.
And it's always great. So yeah, I'm out here, avid listener, first time caller. So
what sparked your interest? Go ahead.
Oh, well, your guest is, he was talking about trafficking in children and body parts and everything else. And I was wondering if he's ever done anything along the lines of CPS. I'm not going to go into really gory details, but it's really a shady operation when you really start getting down and dirty with it. I was wondering if there was any correlations in there for the state-run baby trade that they've got nowadays.
Child Protective Services? No, I have not. I looked mostly abroad at the International Kidnapping to Adoption Network. So what happens abroad is that you'll have these orphanages which are full of children. But there's a big need to be for adoptions from there, except for the fact that as a child is in an orphanage for a longer period of time, their health declines. And then they're not as easy to sell on the international market, where an orphanage can make, you know, about $14,000 to $30,000 on an adoption. So what happens is they start kidnapping kids to keep them fresh, because incidentally, the market for children isn't so different from the market for bananas. Once they go bad, no one wants them. So that was really what I was looking at when I looked at sort of adoption and that sort of thing. Inside America, I think it's less ethically problematic, but surely there are problems.
Scott, are these loving parents who just want a child that are buying these children?
Yes. And when I tracked one child who was kidnapped in 1999, and I tracked them to a town in Wisconsin through sort of record searches and some good old, you know, investigative reporting, they were a very upstanding Christian family. They were teachers at the local high school, and they had three Indian children who they had adopted, and they did it because they wanted to bring. You know, to bring prosperity and happiness
sure.
to a child who wouldn't have had it.
And they did that, right?
They did that for sure, except for the fact they also supported this industry that kidnaps children.
That is deadly. That is unbelievable. What are the ages of these children who are kidnapped and sold?
Usually they're the babies, the people generally want to adopt younger children. So, you know, pre-lingual would be the sweet spot. You know, you want a kid who's 1 or 2 years old.
Now, where do they find these children to kidnap them? I mean, would it be an irresponsible parent who turns their head and the kid's gone?
Well, you know, in India, you know, the idea is that the village raises the child, right? You know, that's one of the beauties of poverty in the third world, is that parenting is not just put on one family member. It's sort of like everyone looks after the kids, and it actually is a reasonably adaptive thing, except for when criminals are around who are out there to kidnap. So it's not just the failing of the mother who may have looked away for 2 minutes. In this case, she was picking up water from a well and carrying the water on her head back to her house when a taxi driver came in and just snatched the child. But it's loving families, poor but loving.
What number, Scott, would you place on kidnapped kids every year for this purpose, selling them?
That is an impossible thing for me to answer.
Is it huge?
Thousands, tens of thousands. It's really, really hard for me to say that in any sort of reliable way.
Worldwide, though.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if we're talking tens of thousands.
Frightening. Let's go to Melissa in South Carolina. Welcome to the program, Melissa. Good to have you with us. Hi, Melissa.
Hello. I have a question. I'm concerned. I was a guardian ad litem who, if you're familiar with that whole program, you are appointed by a governor to serve on behalf of neglected and abused children.
Okay.
And so that last caller, I wasn't prepared for that, but he was so informed that he really moved me. And that wasn't why I was calling initially. But this whole realm is disturbing to me because it's like we're blowing off this girl who thought she had enlightenment and a guru, and she was young. And these people are vulnerable, and we have a lot of people on our planet right now who are very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're taking them on another journey. It's like, oh, this is good. If you die or if you kill yourself or you commit suicide because you're enlightened, that's a good thing. I'm really confused by this.
Well, it's not everybody committed suicide, just this one person, Scott, in your group. But like you said, it happens a lot.
Sure. It's a bit of an epidemic, yeah. And you know, and to some degree, it's not so dissimilar from what happens with ISIS, right, in Iraq and Syria, right? These people who've locked on to this spiritual idea where the next world is better than the world that they're in right now. And when that happens, you can just sort of lose track of any morality that might happen in this world, because the next world is the only thing that matters. And with ISIS, it obviously is incredibly horrible and violent what happens, and it's destructive. But you know, it's a very similar mental process to what happened with my student who found that the next world was so good that she just had to take her life right now to get there.
That is so sad. so remarkably sad. Did she seem happy? I mean, would anybody have guessed this?
She seemed quite happy, and actually we had talked to her, because she acted a little strange right after the initial retreat, after we came out of the silence and we're talking again. She acted a little odd, but everyone was acting a little odd. And we sat her down, and we had a 15-20 minute conversation with her, asking about her experience, and she said it was the most wonderful and blissful experience of her life, and she really exuded that sense of contentment. And so you wouldn't have just noticed it, you know, if you weren't 100% aware,
sure,
that this was a possibility to happen.
And she had no close friends that she shared this possible experience with?
Yeah, I mean, so if the retreat, here's one of the problems with silent retreats is that they're silent, right? And you get into your own head loops, and whatever you're thinking, you're not expressing it to other people. So if she had said to us, hey, you know what, I think I'm an angel, and all I need to do is take my own life, we would have had some very clear signals that we are in the wrong direction. But those just didn't happen. And that, to this day, is something that I am very sorry for.
Okay, let's go back to the call. Sean in Fair Oaks, California, welcome to the program. Sean, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Thanks for helping me out. Appreciate it.
Sure.
I was calling up. I moved to Truckee back in 2003 in the middle of winter from San Francisco Bay Area, and I didn't have any winter clothes. I moved up there and had to work outside, and my body adjusted. It was amazing how much it adjusted. I could melt snow. I could self-regulate my body until I kind of got in an accident and kind of messed my spine up a little bit, and that kind of went away. So a healthy nervous system is ideal for that. That's what I found.
Yeah, man, you are my people. I love it. You know, the fact that we can adapt ourselves to the cold so easily, and that actually makes us, like, robust in general. I mean, that's the point of what doesn't kill us, is that this moderate stress, what we call hormesis, actually makes you stronger. And you know, you can adapt to not having extensive winter coats. And what we do is we go outside and we put on these extra layers because we're scared of the cold, not because it's actually damaging us. And we're scared of, like, just that momentary discomfort, so that now we're not even connected to the world around us. Thank you for saying that.
We have Jim in Huntsville, Alabama now, first-time caller. Jim, you are on the air with Scott Kearney. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a question. Years ago, I read a book on cannibalism, and it said in there that they supposedly stopped it in the 60s in China, you could go to little markets and buy human meat, and I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
Human meat. I was aware of cannibalism in New Guinea, and one of the problems with that was that you would get this disease called kuru, which is a prion disease carried in human brains that can make you sort of similar to mad cow disease. You sort of waste away. As for available human flesh available in China, I've never heard of that. I would be surprised, but, you know, hey, anything's possible.
Well, that's absolutely true. Let's take a few more quick calls. Sue in Los Angeles. Take it away, Sue. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi.
Hey, Susan.
Hi. So I am 40 years old, and during my 20s, I was familiar with the Buddhist practice, going to temples in the West Coast. And I did meet people who studied with Michael Roach, and it did strike me really odd. One thing I noticed about while I was studying Buddhism is that a lot of eccentric intellectuals are really attracted to it, and I think that they also forget that the term bodhisattva is actually a term of meaning a compassionate being, which I think George is a great example of somebody who's really practicing compassion, you know. So it's not like a superpower that you know, people interpret with, like, the teachings of Jesus, and they think of his miracles, but they forget that he was a compassionate person who was just down to the nitty-gritty of life. And so I think that egomania, if I may say so, is really what can be very infectious in those environments. I studied Zen, which is a little different than Tibetan, but I did definitely notice that's what eventually got me out of it, and I didn't feel the love in it. And so eventually I was drawn to the teacher.
Yeah, it's almost, Scott, like a cult, isn't it?
Well, Diamond Mountain is certainly, I would look at it as a cult. You could call it a cult. But I would say that, you know, that, your caller's exactly right. Like, the heart of Buddhism is not about miracles, right? The heart, there are things that are mentioned there. But what it is this misreading of the Western mind as we look at Buddhism. And they have all these stories, and some of them are miraculous stories, and some of them are not miraculous stories. But some people are drawn to that idea of superpowers. And she's right, it's about the ego. But the misreading is very similar as, let's say, an alien came down to Earth and heard about Christianity for the first time. And they're like, oh, it's all about duplicating fishes and turning water into wine and walking on water. Of course, I get you, the religion. And it's that sort of gross misreading, because that's not what Christianity is about, right? But, and this is what we're doing to Buddhism and to Hinduism and these Eastern traditions, is we look at these miracles, which in those traditions are called siddhis, and we think, well, that is the point. You want to become that Superman. When really those are sort of the incidental things to a religion that is wonderfully compassionate and very wholehearted, and you can get so much out of it.
Indeed you can. Scott, give us your website for folks who are driving around and just want to remember it.
Well, it's my name. It's scottcarney.com. That's scottcarney.com. And even if you misspell it, it'll probably come up in a Google search.
Hey, Scott, get back to us when you get this next book finished. Sounds like a great topic that we'd want to cover with you.
I absolutely will. That'll be a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you so much. Scott Carney talking about some of the strangest things I've heard in a long, long time. Well, up next, I'm going to be talking with a New York Times bestseller, and he is an expert on the other side, on vampires, on zombies, Knights of the Living Dead, one of his books. That'll give you an idea what we're going to be talking about here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and send me an email at george@coasttocoastam.com.